scheduled for argument. The first case is appeal number 2010-1478, Woods versus D'Angelo Marine.
Good morning, Your Honor. The district court erred in not granting D'Angelo's motion for judgment as a matter of law on the issue of patent validity. It had also previously refused to grant summary judgment. Validity is an issue of law based on supporting facts. Now, in their responsive brief, Woods argues that there was insufficient evidence presented to the jury. Indeed, there was plenty of evidence, including the prosecution histories and the associated prior art, the specification of the patents at issue, the testimony of D'Angelo's expert witness, David Garrison, and a prior art device that we refer to as the Key Marine device, whose existence as prior art was testified to by three D'Angelo employees who actually worked for Key Marine at the time the device was manufactured in 1987. The argument is, I think, easily taken if we start with the second of the patents that were issued, which is the 633 patent under the application number of the 821 application number.
Could you help me understand?
Yes.
I understand your argument about the district court misconstruing 26E and excluding these documents.
Yes.
And you say that those documents show prior art and were created on sale bar, is that correct?
No, I can't say that. The documents showed what D'Angelo, my client, had been manufacturing in 1990, 91, and before. Mm-hmm. The documents had been misplaced prior to Mr. Montez's coming into possession of the company, when the company went to CAD-CAM drawings. The written drawings were then put away somewhere.
But the drawings themselves are not prior art.
They are not. They are supportive of what was being manufactured. And the same employees who had worked for Key Marine and then came to work for D'Angelo would have testified, we made these, we used these drawings, we manufactured these devices.
Wouldn't that be an on-sale bar?
I think on-sale bar is something, sure. We're not patentee. It isn't our patent. It shows that prior art existed, and it shows what the prior art consisted of that makes the patent invalid, the two patents.
Well, suppose that the district court heard in interpreting 2060. 2060 only applies if you have knowledge of documents and don't turn them over.
We didn't have knowledge.
Okay, I'm assuming.
Sure. That,
but what good would it do you to have the documents introduced into evidence without expert testimony, without other testimony? Disclosing that these products were manufactured, these products somehow made the devices prior art, and combined them with some other prior art that created obviousness arguments.
We did have.
I'm correct, right? That the documents standing alone wouldn't do anything for you.
I think that's correct. We would have had to show they were publicly available. And while we believe they were, I don't know that we would have been able to prove them. The fact is, we were relying on the documents. And the people who used the documents to manufacture products for D'Angelo in the early 1990s, to establish that D'Angelo had manufactured the products that were accused of infringing years before the patent was applied for, years before the invention was conceived. And with
but
that
was an obviousness argument because the even if the things had been manufactured, they were not an anticipatory, right? They had to be combined with some other prior art.
I would say that is correct, certainly with respect to the conical diffuser that had a tail end of its teeth.
Okay, but so the expert testimony was due to be filed earlier. You didn't file any expert testimony discussing these documents, or maybe in the obviousness case, right?
That is correct. We did not have testimony to show obviousness.
So how would the documents standing alone help you?
The documents would establish that we manufactured the same devices in 1990 that are accused of infringement in trial in 2009 or 10. Obviously, if we had been making the same products, we could have been the patent that was filed later.
The documents alone don't establish that.
No. The testimony of the gentleman who worked with the documents, there were three of them, who manufactured the devices for D'Angelo. The problem with...
Was he on your witness list?
Yes, they did testify, but they were not allowed to testify as the documents. The problem is there was a change of ownership.
What were those witnesses going to show with respect to the documents?
They would have shown that, yes, these are the documents we used. We manufactured these devices. We have a conical diffuser. We have D-ring holes at the edges of the diffusers. We had what's also called a notched diffuser, which is a different modification, but showing that. We manufactured the notched diffuser. If these devices were made in 1990, Mr. Woods can't apply for a patent in 1995 and say that devices that existed 5 years earlier infringe his patent.
Yeah, but you said a few minutes ago that these devices would not have been anticipatory, that they had been combined with other prior art to show obviousness. And you didn't, and while your expert testimony was due to be filed before the court excluded these documents, you didn't include any expert testimony on this obviousness point, did you?
We did not include testimony on the obviousness point. I did not think we needed to do that in that instance. We either have non-infringement or we have invalidity. Now, if the claims had been properly construed, I don't think we'd be here today. But the way the claims were construed by the court, we had they covered what we did. And to that extent, I think they would have been anticipatory. There may have been one additional feature that had to be added. Whether it was obvious or not, I think the jury would not have required expert testimony to know obviousness. When you have a device and you make one change to it for a reason unrelated to anything having to do with the patent, I don't know that expert testimony is required to establish obviousness. That is our position there. Now,
you do indicate on the witness list that these witnesses were going to testify in connection with the excluded documents.
I'm not sure whether I did or not. They were certainly deposed with respect to the prior art. No, I didn't, because we didn't know of the documents at the time. That's correct. They'd been deposed. We listed them on the witness list.
But you didn't have to summarize their testimony anyway, right?
No requirement. I understand if this is the issue that the court would find in my favor on, we would be going back for a new trial. I think these claims are invalid. I hope we've covered them well in our brief, but I wanted to touch on that before.
Because of the failure to appeal the earlier rejection?
In part, yes. On the 821 application, which was the third of the evidence.
If you lose on the exclusion of the documents, if you lose on the failure to appeal the rejection as having significance, what do you have left on the obvious one?
Which rejection are you referring to, Your Honor?
The examiner's rejection. Or that they didn't.
That they didn't.
Yeah.
They are bound by prior art known as Luloff. Luloff was not cited in the first application nor the second. Luloff was cited in the third, a 102 rejection of the independent claims 1 and 14. They amended to get over Luloff. Therefore, under the Lemelson versus General Motors.
Yeah, I understand, but I'm trying to put that aside. I'm putting aside the exclusion of the documents. I'm putting aside the argument based on their failure to appeal the rejection. What do you have? If we put those two things aside, what have we got left on the obviousness question?
We have the Shiazawa reference, the Moffitt reference, the Woods' own reference. We have, I think it's well briefed, but we have prior art. Again, Shiazawa was cited against the very first application that became abandoned, a 102 rejection. the continuation in part application that became 670 Peck incorporated most of the limitations that were ultimately rejected. At the time they filed, both applications were pending. There had been no rejection. The 670 application was allowed to go through, and the only additional limitation that appeared in that application was the existence of an extended inner liner. Shia Zawa did not show an extended inner liner, and the examiner, Mr. Hart, gave them, in essence, the first office allowability for that claim. The only difference between Shia Zawa, which ultimately was rejected under 102, and the claim that was allowed was the addition of an extended inner liner. Extended inner liners are shown in the prior art, and indeed Luloff, which was later decided in the third application, the second patent, shows an extended inner liner. It may help to understand a little bit. The first and second applications were examined in one office and by examiner Hart. The argument is what I mean, I'm sorry. One argument. The second, patent, which was actually the third application, was examined by examiner Denny in a different argument. They came up with different pieces of prior art, and they viewed the invention somewhat differently. The only one piece of prior art that was common to both was Shia Zawa. But Luloff makes all of the claims invalid or obvious.
You're in here, well, I assume you want to say that.
I certainly do. Thank you, Ron.
That's very good.
Lou. May it please the court.
Good morning.
As to the issue of the Rule 37 exclusion of documents, this court's review of the trial court's exclusion of evidence is sharply limited to the abuse of discretion standard.
Well, sure, but the problem is that 26E talks about your obligation to disclose things that you discovered.
Correct.
It doesn't have anything to do with your obligation to do the search.
Agreed, but the analysis
so
needs to start from the discovery.
If you relied on 26E, which you did, it was wrong, right?
No.
Why not?
Because part of the analysis, I will agree that the court, looking at harmlessness and fairness, got into the discovery of the documents and why they were discovered so late. But if you look, the court also asked D'Angelo, why didn't they supplement their responses when they found the discovery?
No, but I answered the specific question. Wasn't he wrong to rely on 26E and finding a 26E violation?
No, because 26E requires that you supplement your discovery responses.
It doesn't require you to search for anything. It just says if you discover, read the advisory committee notes,
sure,
look for cases. I don't find any case that says that 26E incorporates a search on.
I agree, but once they found the documents, they did not supplement their discovery responses.
Didn't they notify you the day after they found the documents?
They notified us, if you look at the email, they notified us that they found some documents, they didn't know the significance, and they may constitute prior art. But if you look at the discovery request, the interrogatory specifically that we asked for, we asked that they specifically tell us any prior art that they were going to rely on, that they tell us which claims they thought they went to, and that they tell us how they thought that this prior art was going to implicate those claims. So once they discovered the documents, they failed to supplement their discovery responses by telling us the information that we had asked for and that we rightly had the right to know.
Well, did the district court make its ruling on that basis? I understand what your argument is, but show me where the district court it's really excluding the documents on that particular point, as opposed to the violation of the 26E.
But actually, the district court specifically asked, as part of his analysis, asked D'Angelo why they failed to supplement their responses.
Where did the district court adopt the theory that you're now articulating?
Thank you. So I think, I don't have that in front of me, but I think that if you look at the record of the court, while he did get into some of the analysis.
I assume it's not there.
Oh, it's there. At 471, 12 through 25, the court asked why the interrogatory had not been supplemented.
That's a question.
I'm sorry?
It's a question, not a ruling.
Well,
you made a ruling.
It was part of his analysis.
The ruling relies on 26E. You're not defending this ruling based on 26E. You're now articulating a different theory. I don't see that the district court adopted this different theory. It somehow wasn't sufficient to disclose the documents to that they had to make a formal amendment to the interrogatory response.
Well,
that, I don't see that as being the basis for his ruling. I see the basis for his ruling in misconstruction of 26E.
Respectfully, it seemed to me that the trial court went to great depths to determine what was disclosed to us and what they knew, when they knew it, and whether or not they disclosed the necessary information to us and whether or not we were harmed by their failure to do so. Had they supplemented the discovery, we would not have this analysis.
Did you ever object that there was a faulty supplementation?
We did not. If you look at the email when they said they provided the Section 282 notice, they said, if the trial starts before February, we're going to be inside that 30 days. And if that's the case, let us know if you object, and we'll address it with the court. And as you all know, just providing a Rule 282 notice is not sufficient to satisfy the obligations under 26E. And because the trial didn't start until March, that dialogue that was engaged in the email communication was not engaged. Frankly, we didn't know which documents they intended to use or how they intended to use them until we showed up at trial. In the second week of trial, they start to use these documents in a way that had never been disclosed.
They were listed, were they not, on the pre-trial list?
Well, the documents that they discovered, if you look at the email again, are hundreds and hundreds of pages. What was listed on the exhibit list was a portion of those, and what they intended to use was yet a portion of those. Again, we had no notice and no opportunity to prepare to address these.
How could there be no notice when they listed them on the exhibit?
Well, if I say, you know, here's all the prior art in the world, I'm not going to tell you which one I actually think is appropriate. I have no opportunity at discovery.
But that list does give you notice, and but you have an obligation to object at that time and not wait until later on.
I don't believe so. I think that the same reason, you know, that this followed the exclusion of marine exhaust documents that D'Angelo knew about. They were on our exhibit list for two months
before
the trial.
That issue is not for us, is it?
No, I understand. But I think that the same thing is true, which is that until, I think they were right to not raise it until trial, which is why we never raised the waiver argument. And I think we were justified as well, because until you knew what they were going to use and how they were going to use them, there was no violation.
You can ask.
Discovery was over.
You can still ask which documents you're going to use. Is there any rule that says you can't ask counsel?
No, you're right. I think that, to be honest, when we originally got the disclosure and Mr. Cesarano said, here's some stuff, I don't really know what's in here yet, I anticipated that when they figured it out, they'd let us know. And if they didn't let us know, to me, there was nothing significant in that documentation, which is why we were caught off guard when it showed up at trial. And I think Judge Hurley made the right ruling when he excluded the evidence under Rule 26E.
he excluded it because he says that it came in at the 11th hour. Is there a rule or is there any case law that, that has an 11th hour exception to Rule 26 obligations?
No, sir, and I did not understand Judge Furley's statement in that regard to go to the issue of 26E, but it went to the issue of Rule 37, substantial justification and harmlessness analysis, which you went into in great detail.
So you would agree that the documentation that was provided to you was timely under Rule 26?
It was timely. There was no Rule 26E disclosure. The providing of the documents without answering the questions that we actually asked and without giving us the information that we actually needed is not a satisfactory Rule 26E disclosure.
Well, maybe, but the district court didn't base its decision on that.
I was there, and it seemed to me that he did, and that the rest of the analysis had to do with the substantial justification and harmfulness analysis under Rule 37.
You're saying the record doesn't reflect that. It's just
I thought it did when he inquired as to the reason for not supplementing the interrogatory. So he clearly found, the court found, that the interrogatory had not been supplemented as it was supposed to.
It also listed witnesses who could testify about these documents.
No, actually no. These witnesses that Mr. Cedarmont talked about, first of all, only one of them was even employed at that point that these documents, because they go way back in the 90s. And there was never an establishment that any of these witnesses, these were manufacturers. You know, they got plans, they were told, build this. They were not, or they did not have the ordinary skill in the art to be able to testify on the issues of obviousness that you alluded to earlier. And in fact, no witnesses were identified to testify about these documents at trial.
I wonder, but it's not where you identify witnesses. You list the names of the witnesses, you don't summarize the testimony, but, right?
True, but these witnesses that Mr. Cesarano described, the only witnesses that could talk about these drawings and these devices, and actually there was only one out of those three, D'Angelo employees, was not skilled in the art and could not talk about the obvious.
How do you know he wasn't skilled in the art?
Because he testified in the record. And
he wasn't skilled?
He was a manufacturer of these devices. He had no... There's nothing in the record to suggest that he was skilled in the art. The issue of obviousness, the reality is these drawings, had they been admitted, we would have put on testimony regarding the fact that they showed nothing new and disclosed nothing special that wasn't disclosed in the other prior art and the more relevant prior art already cited, firstly. And secondly, regardless of the elements that existed and the limitations that existed in these drawings, with the secondary addition of non-obviousness that was established through trial testimony in great detail, and the problems that D'Angelo themselves were having with their devices, the significant customers that they were about to lose because of the water migrating back into the engine, salt water, and freezing up the engine, causing thousands and thousands of dollars of damage. And it was Mr. Wood's patent that fixed this problem. And so even if they had some of the elements that were also disclosed in other prior art, there's nothing in the record to suggest that there was a reason to combine these elements and in a manner that Mr. Woods did. And in fact, it was Mr. Woods' special knowledge that he gained from being a commercial pilot.
Aren't you playing both ends here? On the one hand, you're saying that the D'Angelo device infringed. On the other, you're saying that these drawings could not have been anticipatory because they didn't lead to an infringing device.
No, and that's a good question. The drawings were very different than the device that, drawings.
We don't know that. We don't have that in the record.
The drawings are in the record.
The excluded drawings?
Yes. And they are very different from the drawings that are also in the record that were found to infringe. Very different. The 1990 prior I don't say prior art, but the prior iterations of D'Angelo products had gone through many evolutions, including adding the improvements that Woods added, the tapered inner liner, the extended inner liner, to resolve these problems. And those were the ones that the court found infringed.
What's fascinating is that you were asking us to go through the record and find that the exclusion of these documents is harmless error. And why shouldn't we send it back to the district court to figure out if the exclusion was harmless error if we conclude that the exclusion was an error?
Well, I think that a ruling in a vacuum without looking at the issue of obviousness and the technology that existed at the time of the patent applications in 1995. If there's no significant difference between the features that are disclosed in the early D'Angelo drawings and the ones that were identified by the patent examiner, and the patent examiner found that.
Well, that's what exactly my point. You're asking us to compare the two of those and conclude on appeal that there's no difference.
Yes.
Should we send this back to have the district court comparison and see if there's one problem?
Well, I would submit that the ruling of the court was correct, first of all. And then if not, I think that if there is nothing significantly, even if you look at the arguments of D'Angelo, not how they say, but what they say, it is plain on the record that there are no special features, there's no tapered inner liner, there's no special feature that would justify finding that these invalidated Woods prior art.
You're not answering the question.
Well,
the question is
why should we
be making that decision rather than the district court?
Yeah, I understand. I think based on D'Angelo's argument, you have everything that you need to make that decision.
Okay. Thank you very much. Mr. Cicerone, any vote?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Judge Lynn, your last question is why should we be making that decision instead of the district court? I submit that because the claims at issue are invalid, this case should not go back to the district court. I haven't been able to expound my argument. I think it's well documented in the briefs. I would, however, point out the Luloff device was
you don't want to go back to the district.
I don't want to go back to the district court. No, no, Your Honor. I don't.
Should we just affirm it?
No, Your Honor. You should find that Luloff anticipates the claims of the 670 patent. It anticipated the very same claims of the 821 application, with the exception of the 821 application had a limitation for creating back pressure that was added to overcome Luloff. As I'm sure you know from our brief, back pressure was one of the elements in the prior art that was disclosed in the specification itself. And Mr. Wood said, I'm going to improve over the prior art. That makes the back pressure combined with Luloff obvious, as much black letter law as we could ever get in this thing. He cites the prior art and then he amends to include the prior art to make his claims patentable. That simply can't be done. The second step is to look at Luloff in view of the prior application that had been issued before Luloff was ever cited by the examiner. And when we do that, we find Luloff anticipates every limitation. In the prior patent, the 670 patent, the way Woods distinguished himself over the prior art was to have an extended inner liner. Figures 4 and 5 of Luloff show an extended inner liner, and they also show the other limitations of those claims. Now, the beauty or the consequence of this is because Luloff was cited in the 821 application and was not traversed, but was accepted and amended over, the applicant, the patentee, has accepted Luloff. he can't now turn around and say the examiner was wrong or that Luloff didn't say what the examiner said it did. He accepted it. And that's the holding of the Lemels case. The other point I did want to make is on claim construction, and again, I think it's well covered in our briefs. The judge did not want to commit the cardinal sin of importing limitations into claims. As you yourself, Judge Dick, concurred in this...
Dyke.
I'm sorry, sir. I did know that. I'm just a little excited up here. Concurred in the SciMed opinion, you said one of the problems we have is telling the district courts when they can and when they cannot bring limitations from the specification into the claims. In this case, what we have is an invention that requires water to be squirted against, collided against, and deflected off of an outer shell, the inner surface of the outer shell.
If we were to reverse on the basis of the documents, on the ruling on Rule 26, would we have to reverse on all the decisions of the district court, or could we affirm on parts of them?
I don't think you could affirm the claim construction. And that would not be correct. And once we've done that, the infringement analysis goes out the window because they were using the wrong claims. If you affirm on validity, I have a problem because I would think you were wrong, but if you do it, then I have to live with it, of course.
All right, thank you. Your time has expired. I thank
you,
counsel on both sides. So.